Thanks for coming back to another episode of Pitch It, a fintech conversation amongst founders, investors, and friends. I'm your host, Todd Anderson, Chief Content Officer at Fintech Nexus. And what we do is we take a peek behind the curtain. What motivates someone to start a company? How do investors make the right bet? What do accelerators do during and help enabling the process of growing your company? How do banks think of founders? Not to mention, we try to have some fun, and what you'll see is we'll also do some special episodes. We have some new features coming, so stick with us, and you'll get all you'll need to know about the fintech startup landscape. Pitch It is really a part of a larger podcast network here at Fintech Nexus. You can go to my colleague Peter, our co-founder and chairman, for Fintech One-on-One. You can subscribe to his feed, or we have our newest podcast by one of our writers, Isabel Castro, the Fintech Coffee Break. For everything produced by Fintech Nexus, you can check out Fintech Nexus Podcast, which is really our content fire hose. All shows, webinar replays, even in-person event content, not to mention our weekly news show. As always, we hope that you rate the show and write a review. I try to really take listener feedback seriously, and as it helps make the show better. You can also follow the podcast and all of our podcasts on the feed of your choice, whether it be Apple, Spotify, wherever you like to listen, or come directly to news.fintechnexus.com. Now, let's get on with the show. On today's episode, you're going to hear a special version of the Pitch It podcast today. This is our first semifinals of our Pitch It competition 2023. It's a really great competition we've been running. This is our ninth year running the competition now, and it's I'd probably say it's our best group from top to bottom of companies we've ever had. You'll hear some really great founders. I want to give a special thanks to our judges who, you know, give us their time, their attention. So, you know, when you hear the show, stay tuned. There's six companies today. When we post semifinal round two, there'll be eight companies in that batch. There's really, really great content and just a lot of great founders that are trying to build, you know, the next great fintech company. So, you know, I do think, and for me, it really is a passion project. I love talking to founders. I love being involved in running this competition. And I hope you enjoy semifinal one, as well as semifinal two. And ultimately, you know, the show, you know, the finals, which is shameless plug, going to take place May 10th and 11th in New York City. So get your tickets now. Make sure you go to fintechnexus.com for all the event details, whether you want to go to a party or you want to see content. Everything's there. So just check out fintechnexus.com. And now we're going to move on to our episode for this week. It's our Pitch It semifinal round one for the 2023 Pitch It at Fintech Nexus competition. Hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome back to another year here at Fintech Nexus, our Pitch It competition for 2023. We got a real, really great group of companies this year. We have 14 in total. You'll hear six today, six tomorrow. And so semifinal one is today. Semifinal two is taking place tomorrow. A couple of thank yous. First, you know, obviously to the audience, either you know, those watching live now, or those who will listen as a podcast or watch on YouTube, you know, we appreciate your time and attention. If you, obviously, without a great audience and a great community as we've built, hard for us to, you know, put on these sessions. So we appreciate that time and attention. I want to thank our founders today. We have a really great group ahead of us. So stay tuned. What you're going to see is 7-minute pitches followed by some Q&A with our judges. Speaking of those judges, I do want to give a special thanks to our group today and tomorrow. But today, I want to give a thanks to Catherine Zai at City Sprint, George Cecil at JM FinTop, Liran Amrani at Team 8, and Sandeep Bakshi at Prosys. Without judges obviously helping us out, then I'd be judging everything. And so we really appreciate their time and energy in stepping into the competition. And before we turn it over to our first founder today, I do want to remind you there's still tickets. So May 10th and 11th, New York City. Get your tickets. If you're an early stage founder who might be listening or watching this, we have special pricing for you and all sorts of different tickets, whether it's bundle tickets, single tickets. You just go to fintechnexus.com for details, or feel free to reach out to me, todd@fintechnexus.com. Now, without further ado, let's get our competition started. First up, we have Karen Moynihan. Karen is with Boss Insights. Karen, take it away.
The opportunity that we are presenting is enabling fintechs and financial institutions to move from just offering financial transactions to offering financial services. And there is a difference there. The next time a business customer comes to you, we say to our client, to ask for whether it's a loan, a payment solution, a deposit, instead of just solving that one immediate problem for them, have that real-time live connectivity to their accounting, to their banking, to their sales, to their payroll, to their IRS data, and show them more about how to grow their wealth. Because here's the real problem. If your business customer is not relying on you as a key partner to help them grow their wealth, you do not have a true customer engagement process. And this is what the difference looks like. It's not just getting that payment and charging a fee for that payment, but having connectivity to accounting to show that there are deposits available and helping them earn more interest. Having connectivity to payroll to show them how to retain key talent, and enabling you to get access to the assets under management or deposits on the individual side, or telling them ways in which that business can plan for the future with life insurance, tax planning, succession planning. You get the idea. That's where our award-winning open finance platform for business does. It is these direct feeds that you need access to anyway in order to support the business that allows fintechs and financial institutions to move from transactional to relationship-based. You see here, it's not just here's your loan, here's your payment. It's here are insights that enable you to grow. And it really does make a difference. You can see that when financial institutions and fintechs adopt this platform, they are seeing results from a cost savings perspective, and they are growing their own business. So it's win-win. We have seen unprecedented growth, and we are already on track to get to a million ARR this year. And as I already mentioned, we have that large pipeline in place, and we're going to see exponential growth year over year. Our revenue model is B2B SaaS. We are supporting monthly subscriptions, and we have three revenue streams. It can be data, insights, or support. Because here's the thing, this is not just a commoditized offering for data feeds. It's the ability for a fintech and financial institution to tell us what their largest challenges are, and our system is agile enough to support that. So our round is a $3 million round, and the purpose of it is to close on that $8 million pipeline, to automate the sales and marketing systems that we have in place, and to grow our team. We're going to invest in the marketing automation at $1.7 million and in product and engineering to stay ahead of class at $1.3 million. And we invest in this industry. There's a lot of talk out there about open banking and open finance, and Boss Insights is a thought leader in the space. We are an advisory board member in Open Banking Expo. We're the co-chair of the SMB Task Force at FDX. And if anyone would like to hear more about that, we met at the summit last week. Happy to share the findings there on what use cases banks want to see adopted this year. And we're really excited to be speaking at over 50 industry conferences in the last few years. So what I'd like to close off with is explaining that a real-time data feed, an insights feed, that is not just a commoditized offering, does make the difference. We've shown it with use cases, we've shown it with thought leadership, and we are really excited to be here at FinTech Nexus telling it to you today. I'm Karen Moynihan. Let's transform financial services together.
Thanks, Karen. Judges, do we have any questions?
I'll chime in. Thanks, Karen. What does the integration look like? What is that process? What's required from the bank's perspective?
Thanks for the question. It is the number one question we get when people are onboarding. After 80 integrations, we're really proud of the fact that the time to integrate is 2 weeks or less. So it's really quick. We have a developer's portal, and banks, credit unions, fintechs have the choice of our white labeled platform or the ability to grab our API docs and go into our sandbox, or they can even embed our visualizations into an online banking tool, a loan operating system, or a CRM.
And that was actually my first question as well, but maybe adding to it, what's your kind of target, you know, banking partner, banking customer look like? Are these mostly BaaS banks? Are they, you know, just business heavy kind of community regional banks? Just some more color there would be awesome.
And the truth is, we're working with both of those two players. BaaS offerings, because not all community banks are set up to solve this problem, larger institutions as well, and community banks, as well as fintechs. And the common thread really is, I'd like to serve the business use case. We, you know, the question that we keep putting out in market is, how do you define your SMBs? And most financial institutions are defining them from the point of view of their revenue benefit. So an SMB is a business that borrows up to $250,000, not from the point of view of the SMB. What we're solving for these players is a scaled way to serve the small and medium business. Because the true definition of small and medium business from our industry is, these are businesses that are incredible. The industry is growing really quickly, but as an individual business, it's very challenging to actually serve them in a way that we can make our own revenue numbers. What we've done is put in this data and insights layer that allows them to serve those businesses at scale.
Thanks, Karen, for the presentation. This is very interesting. I do find it very interesting that you're approaching the problem from a data insight layer. There are a lot of players in the market who are more focused on specific verticalized use cases, such as financial spreading, loan servicing, and others. How do you think your position compared to them, and what are your competitive advantage compared to those more verticalized solutions?
Thanks for the question, Catherine. As a former banker, that one is near and dear to my heart. We weren't solving loans for small and medium businesses. We weren't solving payment solutions. We are looking to get the whole relationship. And I almost wish that everybody was there with me at FDX last week, because you could have heard the bank say exactly the same thing I'm saying to you now. We want to serve the entire relationship. And the truth is, a single solution isn't going to do that. Businesses need help with payments, with foreign exchange, with deposits, with retirement planning, with wealth management. And if you have one solution, you're telling that business owner that they need to go elsewhere. And the proof is in the pudding. 5 to 7 financial relationships. Businesses, I'm going to use an outdated reference, are MacGyvering their solutions. And they are the ones that have to come with, I need this product. They're not the experts. We're the experts. It's our job to make it easy for them to adopt.
You mentioned 80 customers that are already integrated. Mm-hmm. How many like SMBs from those 80 partners have been using the platform? And do you have any like engagement data on like, you know, how long they continue to use it after they first try it out?
I can answer part of the question, Liran, and part of it I'm happy to answer in a deeper call if you'd like. On the engagement numbers, we actually show in different relationships 80 to 100% engagement. Now that sounds really exciting. Here's how we've achieved it. only half of the businesses actually have access to cloud accounting data at the moment. And that's what other data aggregators are not necessarily sharing. So if you only have cloud-based connectivity, you're immediately cutting out half of the market. And it could be because they don't have the connectivity. It could also be because they're not yet ready to share their data. But we enable digitization of both PDF information and actually digitization on the API side. So we are moving with the innovation curve. And then on the number of businesses, I'm happy to share more details with you on a separate call, Ilan.
Thanks, Karen. Great presentation. Quick question. So you're an early stage company, and I'm on your website right now, and there's a number of different solutions across industry and across use cases. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, for an early stage founder, there needs to be a component of focus. Who do you think is going to be your target customer? So let's assume you raise the $3 million. You need mm-hmm. to go out and, you know, attract some of these customers. What's the target customer, and what's the one line pitch that basically gets them to use the product?
Okay. So the target customers are split 50% fintechs focusing on SMB, 50% banks focusing on SMB, and that's it. The tool is always the same, regardless of what you're seeing on the use cases. Those are SEO issues. And the last part of your question, can you just remind me, Sandeep?
So, okay. So you're going to be targeting fintechs and banks. And mm-hmm. specifically, what problem for them are you trying to solve?
Like the one line, the most important, the one line. We are your data and insights partner to allow you to focus on increasing your business client engagement at scale.
Okay, I'm going to pick at that a little. So what does that actually mean? So if I'm a loan officer, if I'm a commercial banker, which obviously you were, what specific product am I trying to solve? And actually, how does the cost of your product impact kind of the unit economics that I'm targeting, especially in this market?
And you bring up the reason we say it like that is then they say, great, I'm trying to solve this problem. How do you help me? In the case of a loan officer, great. Instead of asking your business owner or the accountant to send you a PDF of financials and then you calculate it manually and it takes months, we're going to have a live feed to the accounting software tool. We're going to accelerate lending by 50%, scoring by 100%, and your renewals and monitoring will be accelerated by 80%.
Okay, so would it be fair to say that the secret sauce here is that you've basically done a lot of the work to develop integrations into a number of different softwares? So that's the
data side. And then the insight side really makes the data much more usable than a flow through data provider.
Okay, yeah. Thank you.
Thanks for the questions.
Okay, we're going to have to cut it there for Karen. So thank you, judges, and thank you, Karen.
Thank you, everybody.
Next up, we have Conductiv and have Gopal Swami. If you can step to the stage, the virtual stage, and share your screen, and your 7 minutes will start once your presentation is up.
Awesome. Can you guys see my screen?
Yes, we can. So take it away, Gopal.
Awesome. So thanks, Karen. That was a great start to things. I'm Gopal Swami. I'm the CEO of Conductiv. Definitely excited to talk to you guys today. In a nutshell, we are a data-driven lending guidance. So you'll see some themes, I think, across all the presenters today. What we do is we go to small lenders. So lenders who have about $10 billion in assets under management and below. That's about 8,000 of them in the United States. And we help them reach new customers, make more money, but also minimize risk. And before I get into Conductiv, I think it's very important to talk a little bit about small lenders and consumer lending. Small lenders are not like big lenders. When you apply online, about 10% of the time, they can say, yes, I'm going to give you this loan. Similarly, about 10% of the time, they can say, no, I'm not going to give you this loan. But because they are so interested in serving the community, either as a community bank or as a credit union, they're going to what's called pend a large percentage of your applications because they want more data to figure out how to say yes. This is a big challenge. And why do they pend so often is because they're relying on FICO or bureau data to make that decision. And while FICO/bureau data is good data, it's missing a certain subset of data that's very, very powerful. And that subset is called permissioned data. As a result, they can't make the decision. And so what happens? Well, some human has to call you and say, hey, Gopal, can I have your tax returns? Can I have your bank balances? Can I have this? Can I have that? It's very true that, you know, none of us want to do this anymore. And so the drop-off is really precipitous. So let's dive a little bit deeper into the data gap before we get into conductive. It's the reason why the bureaus are missing this data is because the data that's transactional and at account levels is sort of hidden behind these walls. We have to permission somebody in to get them. And if you know Plaid, you know this very easily, right? I have to tell them that I am banked with Citibank. I have to provide them my username and password, and I have to permission in. What our customers tell us is, oh my God, we need to fill this data gap so we can get a clearer view of the applicant and not just approve more loans, but start winning back a lot of the business that we're losing to competitors. So that's what Conductive does. We go beyond FICO to gather this missing or new data. And what we do is increase the approval rates by significant margins without increasing risk. In a nutshell, this is our one slide. We try and be this brain that talks to all these different data sources. And what the lenders get from us is they'll take somebody who's a maybe or a soft no or even a soft yes, and they'll gather data, which will turn them into a hard yes. And that's tremendously transformative. More revenue, less work, more approvals. So there's a lot going on for the small lenders over the last couple of years. I want to talk about it for one moment. Small lenders used to have a really powerful advantage. They had an office on the corner of Main Street and Main Street. You would go in and get great customer service. COVID changed that. You couldn't go in. So now is the tipping point. You know, we passed it. All of our customers are calling us and saying, hey, we can't continue as business as usual. We need something to transform ourselves. And so this is why Conductive is doing very well right now. I'll move quickly through this slide. Lending is huge. I'm just going to say in North America and in the United States, we're focused on the 8,000 lenders who have $10 billion in assets under management and below. And the platform is a single API to thousands of data points. It is easy to implement. There's all kinds of great stuff. But on top of that, there is a machine learning solution that gleans the insights and pulls out the correlations between the data points we get across all of our customers and the outcomes they care about, approval and funding loans and default rates. So we have found from a pricing perspective that it's good to give these small lenders 90 days to figure out how to use the data before we slap on a monthly minimum. We can get into this in detail, but this is working really well for us from a sales perspective. And what has that produced? Well, we have 6 customers and we have a whole slew of them on the way. The revenues are written here, but the thing I want to really focus on is that if you want to sell to these small lenders, you have to understand that you're trying to crack a fragmented and protected market. It is very hard to get in. It's not enough to just have good technology. And so what we've managed to do is crack that. And while doing so, establish a differentiator. What we did is we took investment from CMFG Ventures. They're one of the leading VC firms within the credit union space. We partnered with the Filene Research Institute, which has relationships with hundreds of credit unions and is a think tank. And we also integrated with one of the leading loan origination system providers that has about 2,000 customers. And we're using this wedge to get in front of a whole bunch of other customers. I've named some prospects here. I probably should remove them, but our customers are on there as well. And you can see that this growth is happening very fast. The other thing that I want to point out is that we are talking to community banks and building the same go-to-market. Now, I'll switch gears a little bit and talk about our differentiators. The first thing is I'm a 3-time entrepreneur. I exited my last business, but almost more importantly, I spent some time working at a very big bank where I did this, and a couple of the team members who joined me as consultants also did exactly what we're talking about. and recovered a slew of money for the large bank. Two, we realized that lenders really don't want us to store their customers' personally identifiable information. So we don't. And that's a big differentiator, because if someone were to break into our servers, what they would be able to take would not contain any PII. It's extremely reassuring to the banks and credit unions we sell to. The third thing is what I mentioned before, which is from an insights perspective, it's one thing to sort of help people on a loan by loan basis, but it's another thing to aggregate those learnings and look for patterns and use machine learning to deliver deeper insights. And we're doing that already. And as we grow, it's going to be very, very hard for someone to come along and replicate that. I don't have exact financials here, and I'd like to talk about that with anybody who's interested. But all I want to say is there's a very clear path to 100 million in ARR just going after credit unions and community banks. But we're also getting interest from real estate companies, insurance companies, a few other verticals. So if somebody has questions about that, we do see ourselves growing into those areas, and the TAM gets even bigger. The ask right now is $1 million. The VCs who have already invested in us are on the right-hand side. Largely, we're going to use the money for PR and sales and marketing and customer success, because we've done a good job of building the platform. The team is myself. Our CTO comes from Citi and other big banks. And then we have some advisors from the space. And Stephen is a gentleman who was on my team at the big bank. So I just want to leave you with this last piece. You know, the tagline we have is better, faster, and fairer decisions for lenders. That's specifically targeted to community banks and credit unions, because of course they want to make money, but they also want to help the communities that they serve. And so when we give this data to them, they are able to make loans to people with lower FICO scores. So there is a sort of equity piece to what we do, though we don't lead with it. So you had asked a cool question earlier. I don't know who it was, but we got some good feedback from one of our customers, and they said, we love you because you guys, it's less work, more loans, more deposit accounts, and happier customers. So that's Conductiv.
All right. Thank you, Gopal. Judges,
sure.
Any questions?
I can kick us off here. Yeah. So on the, you know, kind of the permission data piece, you mentioned, you know, a lot of things being obviously kind of blocked off, walled off without permission. But how is this platform kind of facilitating access to that data? Or are you working with partners like the Plaids of the world, like the, you know, maybe plugging into QuickBooks or the like, curious.
You got it. Very much so. So from a product perspective, what we're talking about is, yes, the integrations, but what the user sees or the applicant sees is an innocuous pop-up or interstitial. And it says, hey, Gopal, thanks for your loan application. If we can get your bank balance or we can get your tax returns, we can give you a fairer shake, get back to you more quickly. And so part of our expertise is how do you build that language, and what words you use and how do you build the UI. But it is very much that innocuous pop-up tied to the loan origination system where we push the data, and also these integrations to the data sources.
And what's your kind of, you know, go to kind of lending vertical?
Okay. So somebody said it before, and I agree completely. Like, we have to really focus. What we're doing today is we're finding the 1900 credit unions and community banks who are already on the Meridian Link loan operating system, loan origination system. We're fully integrated with them. And so it only takes us 2 days to get you up and running. That's one of the bigger problems is working with little lenders. They don't have IT staffs and they don't have a lot of people, and they have a lot of what's called project fatigue. So we come in and say, look, you don't have to worry about any of that. You just give me your website and say yes. And in 2 days, we'll have absolutely everything set up, including the integration. And then you tell you know, MeridianLink when you want to go live. Now, if they have control over their website, their loan origination system or their website, then great, we can integrate that way. But we're finding that the fastest path to revenue is through this channel partnership. And we're building other partnerships with similar institutions, but that's really the way to go in this space.
Thanks, Gopal. Great presentation.
Sure.
Quick question. So on that last point that you made, so you mentioned earlier, if I recall correctly, that there is one API. So actually there is no API if you're on this Meridian system. Like ultimately you don't need to have a dev team.
Yeah. So the single API is what we have. And MeridianLink calls that API.
Sure.
So there's no work for the bank or the credit union to do if they're on that system. If they're not on that system, they do have to call our API.
Clear. Hence the go-to-market, which is clear. Second question, what's the dollar quantum and number of individuals that have been given loans that have been that kind of using your system? And what has been the tenor, like basically as many metrics around that you can give? So tenor and defaults.
So there's frankly a bit of a trick here. I'll kind of answer the question backwards. If I go to small lenders and I tell them to do new things with new data, it's very difficult. What we do instead is we say, you keep doing what you're doing today. We're just making it less work so you can get to more loans and happier customers. So we don't actually get them to do anything new. Over time, we start tracking these additional metrics that are basically like credit attributes. And we start tracking the correlations between those new attributes and the outcomes they care about. We're not there yet. We will be there in about 3-4 months.
Okay. So today,
so to your point is,
go ahead.
To your point, but this is the main question. The default rates won't increase right now because they're not using net new data points. And that's really the way that you've got to sell to folks like this. You have to be safety first. But as we get more and more data and show more and more correlations, it becomes very, very easy for smaller lenders to say, oh my God, I see the correlation. It's a simple heuristic. I'm going to start using that data point.
But sorry, to take a bit of a counter view and correct me if I'm wrong.
Sure.
So what I've heard then is that I will give a loan today. I will use your software, but it won't actually impact my decision-making process. But I will pay you a fee for that loan today
almost. So what it would be is Gopal applies and he's on the margin and you need to verify my income. Today, what you're doing is somebody calls me and sends me an email. I never really get back to you. You spend more money and it's a big pain in the butt. With Conductive, we're giving you the data that you would have asked for anyway. You're looking at it, you're verifying my identity, but you're not doing anything. I'm sorry, verify my income, but you're not doing any net new calculation. Conductive is just smoothing that path out for you. So the time to loan drops dramatically and you get the customer in the future. And so that's why they're paying, because we've just saved them a huge pain and actually gotten them a customer they otherwise wouldn't get because it takes them so long to do it.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
How much are you charging per application?
It depends on the customer. You can't, auto loans have, there's a bigger spread, you know, HELOCs, there's a different spread, personal loans, but the long story short is, you know, roughly $50 a pop. However, there's a monthly minimum. That's sort of the way we protect ourselves, so to speak.
On the last point where you mentioned the future, you're looking to get into the business of adding new data and insight point to help them make their credit decision. Of course, using AI and machine learning to influence credit decisioning is very topical in the market. Would you make sure the accountability actually sit with human and then the human who are using your data analytics actually understand the decision they're making?
So this is a really good point. When we speak to the lenders, we emphasize what sort of Sandeep and I went back and forth on just now, that while we may be using machine learning techniques and technologies to learn insights, we're not making the decision for you. We're simply presenting the data to you. what we're doing is we're getting you the thing that you asked us for, like the very straightforward thing. That's why, you know, the lenders come back to us and say, great, less work, more loans. I love it. The second stage, or maybe a conversation with a slightly larger institution, you know, like 5 billion in assets or maybe 10 billion in assets under management. For them, they may have the team of you know, machine learning folks or data scientists. For them, we can have a conversation and say, okay, what could we give you besides that initial piece of the data? We have some insights on it. Would you like them? Would you like us to turn the insights into scores? But I find that I can't push these customers beyond their comfort levels. So it is what we like to call there are multiple points of entry and graduated points of entry, depending on the sophistication of the lender.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there for Gopal. Gopal, thank you very much. Thank you, judges, for the questions. And next
thank
up,
you, everybody.
Yep, thank you. Next up, we have David Noe of FinGoal. Davey, there you are. How are you? If you want to pop up your screen and your 7 minutes will start. As I see it right there, your 7 minutes starts right now.
Great. Howdy, everybody. I'm David Noe, CEO here at FinGoal. We're based just outside Boulder, Colorado. And we are in the business of helping the financial services industry understand their existing customers better so that they can serve them more. Put differently, we increase cross-sell and upsell conversion, and we do it quickly. Let's talk a little bit about how we do it. It's not crazy complicated at the conversational level anyway. We input messy, raw transaction data, and that can be held by our customer, or it can be aggregated in over any of the data access provider or aggregator rails. We don't care. We can take it from virtually any source, clean it up, normalize it. Okay, we clean up those transactions. Lots of people clean up the transactions. It's kind of becoming a commodity service. We do it because we have to get to the really cool stuff. Then what we do on top of those cleaned up transactions is we are delivering tags at the user, the account, and the transaction level that predicts life events and needs. And then we go a step further and we match your existing customers to your existing offers so that you can target your customers with, as the industry calls it, your next best offer. Let's go and just give a quick example. And this is from real data, real example, with some of the tags and sorts of things that we see. So in this case, we are looking at a consumer's checking account. And we didn't even get credit card data on this particular user. And we noticed all sorts of things about their buying habits, income habits, things like that. And a really interesting thing that was discovered, and we're seeing this a lot now, is small business behavior hiding in plain sight inside of consumer accounts. And for this customer, that's really what they cared about. They wanted to discover where are their opportunities to convert consumer accounts into small business, in this case, payments accounts. And when we identified for these folks, 7% of their consumer accounts had within some revenue thresholds, small business activity hiding in plain sight. We identified, we tagged it, we matched them to relevant offers. Now, in this case, and we've simplified it a little bit. All right, we see small business legal expense. We see revenue coming in $1,700 five times a week from Square, super cool. And because we have access and we can tag with really good fidelity who their wholesalers are, who their suppliers are, we can make a really educated guess about the type of business this is. So not only does this account holder get targeted with an offer in the small business world, but they get targeted with creative and copy that speaks to them so that the user feels seen. I'm not saying anything crazy when I share the thought that more relevant and more personalized offers convert at a higher rate. We see anywhere between 30 and 40%, but consistently in that range from whatever the baseline is from our customers. So 30 to 40% increase in click-throughs and conversions into new products for existing customers. An example of what we do to kind of stand out right up front, we'll take incredibly messy data. What you typically see is what is in the middle column. This is what most of the industry would return back for transaction cleansing. And we go even further. We go into the really small long tail of merchants and service providers and kind of counterparties to payments and things like that. But there's a reason we do it. We don't do it because anybody's going to pay us more to clean up messy transactions because we got a local mom and pop convenience store, right? We might win a deal because of it, but no one's willing to pay for that as an upgrade. Trust me, we've tried. The reason that we go to that level of fidelity is because it's in those small merchant transactions, it's in that outlier behavior that we really get the unique insights at the account holder level, that we really can tell what's going on in their lives on a transaction to transaction, which means day by day basis. So by understanding who's on the other side of every one of those transactions, we can build that rich profile of the customer. I'm going to skip this slide. I think it's, we can talk about it on a Q&A if we want. Let's talk about traction. I think that's super, super fun. It's no surprise that right now doing more with the customers you have is really, really meaningful. And our revenue is growing to show that. We've got some customers that you've heard of. We've got some small customers maybe you haven't heard of. And we often sell through distribution partners, and you see some of them at the bottom. But we've got, I think there's 9 customers on the slide. We've got 10 in total. One doesn't like us to talk about them. That's cool. We've got some awesome investors at both the fund and at the individual level, which is great. We just closed a round of funding about 8 weeks ago. And that's us. That's FinGold. Comments, questions?
All right. Thank you, David. Judges, any questions for David?
I can start us off. So personalization and customer behavioral profile is not a new thing, especially in the context of e-commerce. What do you think are some of the unique challenges in financial services? And then how are you coping with those challenges that the horizontal players may not be able to solve?
Oh man, that's a brilliant question. Okay, so there's a couple pieces to that. So one is the horizontal players and what advantages do they have? E-commerce and customer acquisition has been, like Marcom, has been at the forefront of this kind of stuff for a long, long time. And if you are a target, for example, and you've got your walled garden of data, you know a lot about loyal target customers. And you probably know more about those loyal customers than maybe I do at the what brand of toilet paper do they buy. Totally cool. The issue is financial services as an industry is terrible at personalization. And this is true up and down the industry. It doesn't matter if you're talking to Chase or you're talking to a community bank with 10 million in assets, say 100 million in assets. All of them are really bad at it. And I think there's a handful of reasons for that we can get into. But at the end of the day, you're not going to be able to get that kind of e-commerce level walled garden of data, and as a financial services provider, get access to all of that, right? Target's not going to share that. Amazon's not going to share that. But instead, you've got your own walled garden of data that you hold on to, or it's being user permissioned, just like Conductive was sharing, that you can get access to better serve your customers. And the trick is doing more with that data. And that's where we're attacking. We're saying, hey, banks, credit unions, wealth, you've got a ton of data about those users. I know you're doing cool stuff in fraud prediction and cool stuff in underwriting. Let's talk about what you can do to actually better target those customers with things that you already have, instead of going and trying to acquire for a ton of money new customers. Does that answer your question, Catherine?
Yes. We have been on our own journey of personalization. Would be happy to chat more about this.
Yeah, totally.
How much of the flows that you were showing are generated by FinGold versus the actual FI? So like you have, you know, the copy, like the initial kind of call to action, and then you click on it, and then what happens is that's still sort of your flows and copy there, or does it just go straight into the regular funnel at that point?
Yeah, great question. So today it's going into the regular funnel. An obvious place that we can expand product is by taking over more of that. Not just so that we can maybe be a little bit faster at it, but more importantly, so we can have better tracking and do like even better tuning of our machine learning.
With kind of some of the consumer data privacy, you know, CCPA, a lot of regulatory, you know, regulators are focused here. What are the, obviously having all this data, you know, fed through your system could be worrisome for them as they're doing vendor due diligence. How do you guys kind of qualm, you know, those worries?
Yeah, great question. I think there's two pieces to that. So one is, what do, you know, whether it's California Privacy Act or even going as far as GDPR, what does that mean to our business? Is that a risk? And so, you know, I think the quick answer is you can look at some of the large risk-averse companies and regulated industries that we're already working with that we've been able to overcome those hurdles. That's the quick answer. We can talk about exactly how you do that. The other half to that, though, is it a good thing or a bad thing for us to have more privacy regs? And we maintain that it's tailwinds for us, because as the ability to track folks' location, track cross-site cookies and things like that becomes tougher and tougher for a whole bunch of reasons, right? Then user permission data coming through like over the financial rails is going to have a bigger and bigger marginal impact on what you can do for any individual user. Because if you can track their locations, if you can track their web and social network behavior, you could probably do a lot of really cool stuff, maybe even better than what we can do. But as those channels get shut off, then it's, well, what now? What can we do? And the answer is use the data that you have and use additional user permission data that users have good reason to give you through the aggregators, et cetera. Meanwhile, we store as little data as possible. Nothing that we learn about one customer can be used to inform another customer. We can't sell the data, anything like that, right? And in any of the US-based regimes, we fall under most folks' existing privacy policies. If you're over in Europe, it's a little ambiguous, but the safest bet is that you simply have to disclose Fingal by name in your privacy policies that we're analyzing it on your behalf. But we're really just stepping into the shoes of the FI here. We are not creating something that we can then take this user profile and sell or offer to third parties, even through like a level of orchestration in between. It'd be cool if we could, you know, it would be all like a massive revenue stream. But at the end of the day, the best long-term path for us is to step into the shoes regulatory-wise of the FI and simply analyze the data on their behalf.
Can you talk a little bit about your go-to-market strategy? It looked like from the page where you went through customers that there were a bunch of different types there. So like who is your target customer and what's the plan there?
Yeah. So unlike a lot of folks in the space, we don't target by asset size or things like that. We have three things that we care about for to say, are you a customer? Number one, you need to have access to at least some transaction data. You don't need all of it, but you need some transaction data on some of your users. We can help you think about how can you access more over time, but we can add value as long as you have 30% of the transactions for a subset of your users. That's number one. Number two, you need to have at least five different things that you might want to put in front of your average customer. Because if you're, let's say you're a neobank, you launched with a debit card and you just came out with personal loans and that's all you've got, we might be able to help you with more targeted creative, but you already know what you're going to target them with because you only have two products, right? It gets really interesting with more established institutions that have multiple product lines, and they don't have to be loans and deposits and payments. It can be, you know, ancillary or affiliate offers, it can be card linked offers, all of that's fair game, but you need to have a lot of different things that you could offer to your customer. And then finally, it kind of goes without saying, you need some method of delivering targeted content or offers. With banks up and down the size, not tier one, but going down from there, asset size is not a predictive metric to figure out how sophisticated is your marketing stack. Basically, you need to have something that is at least as sophisticated as MailChimp, or going all the way to something like Adobe or Salesforce or Segment for like really targeted customer data platforms. But if you're just doing a complete shotgun spray and pray right now, and you don't have a way to deliver targeted offers, if we give you the segmentation, you probably have other problems that you need to solve first. We can bring in partners to suggest, but you're probably not ideal for us.
But generally banks, and because I thought I remember that like Yodlee was on there, a couple other sort of non-bank entities, right?
Yeah, so InvestNet's a customer. They use us for advisor insights, identifying other things that are happening in the life cycle of a wealth client, along with some other cool stuff that we do with them. But it's broadly, it's financial services. We don't have any direct contracts with banks or credit unions today. We're generally selling into one of their platforms, like one of their existing vendors that then is offering us to a bunch of their customers.
Any other questions? Okay.
Cool.
Thanks very much, David. All right. Next up, we have Danae Vashada of Grounded. Danae, there you are. All right. If you could share your screen and your 7 minutes will start. There we go. We can see it. So Danae, take it away.
Great. Hello, everyone. Thank you for your time today. And I'm Danae Vakada. I'm the co-founder and CEO of Grounded Technologies. We help financial institutions grow. Problem. We are in a liquidity crisis. As we all know, Jerome Powell's highlight remark after the SVB collapse was, how in the world did this happen? And today, CFOs cannot access a granular picture of deposit cost, current liquidity, and upcoming funding needs. In addition, as the market is constraining, finding core deposits is a painful, lengthy process. This was relevant pre-SVB, and it is more relevant in this current market. And financial teams currently manage their funding and liquidity using Excel spreadsheets. Our solution is to provide a marketplace to help financial institutions achieve regulated balance sheet growth through core deposits, broker deposits, a book of loans, and our network of CDFIs and NDIs for CRA credit. Our primary focus today is on the core deposit marketplace. And why us? Our one-touch solution makes it possible for large deposit holders to share assets and deposits to seamlessly maintain optionality, liquidity, and yield. What we're seeing today with the educated investor and large deposit holders is they are very familiar with the interest rates markets today and the need for their deposits. So, you know, even a 1 to 2 bip difference for them when they're sitting on $30 billion is meaningful. We are built on a multinational bank, with its recent acquisition makes them the fifth largest commercial bank by assets in the US. And BMO moves our assets and liability, allowing us to be a trusted entity that has undergone compliance, risk, and regulation tests, both on the US side and the Canadian side. And BMO is a committed financial institution for their CRA initiatives, and they maintain an excellent status. Some of our deposit examples include asset managers, I think 401k, 1031 exchange, class action lawsuits, opportunity zones. We have a really diversified mix of our deposit products that are long stable products. And how it works, RIAs sign up into our account at BMO and they move their deposits over. Sometimes they have specific requests of saying, hey, we want to have 10% of our deposits going to an MDI or CDFI. And then we put that parameters within our system. And then on the other side, we have a bank network that onboards into the BMO platform as well, our BMO grounded platform, and we instruct BMO where to send the assets and liabilities. So if we take SVB out of this photo and say, you know, where is deposit needs in the market? It has been a growing ecosystem. Last year, we saw 13% growth. 21% of all bank funding was purchased as on the wholesale broker deposit networks. There is an even greater need for a core deposit versus a broker deposit. And that represented $4.3 trillion of funding that was purchased. And if you took a spread of a 40 bps, that represents $17 billion last year. Where we are, we've raised a pre-seed, a seed. We secured BMO to be our custodial bank. And as of this week, we are moving assets onto the platform with BMO from our RIA partner as our first customer. And then within the next couple of weeks, we will start integrating our bank customers and our financial institution customers to move those deposits and loans. A little bit about our team. My co-founder and CTO is Pete Ciccino. He took a bank, digitized it from 1993 to 1999. He sold it to Hudson United and then became a founding member of Bancorp Bank. As we know, Bancorp was the first banking as a service provider and launched a lot of the neobanks that we know today from Chime, Varo, PayPal, et cetera. And then he went over to Harvest and Harvest sold to Investet Yodlee in 2021. And we came together at that time to launch Grounded Technologies. And here are some of our investors. BMO and Susquehanna was our primary seed investors. And then our pre-seed institutional was Rare Breed and Debut Capital. And we had a series of leaders from all different types of financial institutions and hedge funds that participated in our pre-seed round.
All right. Thank you, Danae. Any questions for Danae?
Look, I think this is a particularly, you know, relevant problem right now, deposits, right? All of our investors are banks, and this is obviously a huge focus right now. One of the huge areas of focus, and I think one of our thoughts, something that we'll see kind of continue to trend in the market is around kind of non-insured deposits and those probably going down in a major way after all these most recent bank failures. How do you guys, you know, kind of anticipate, is there kind of, you know, are you guys solving for that piece as well through some sort of a, you know, sweep network or something like that?
Yeah, thank you. That's a really great and very relevant question. So pre-SVB, our asset managers or the people providing deposits really didn't have a focus on insured deposits post-SVB. That topic has become more relevant. And as you may know, there are players in the market like a StoneCastle, IntraFi, that has insured cash sweep and reciprocal deposits. So our primary goal is to move a core deposit into a bank, and let's say it's $50 million for one financial institution. And if either side wants to insure it, then we could partner with IntraFi and then on the back end create it as a reciprocal equal in, equal out. So it remains a core deposit on that bank's balance sheet. What we are trying to do and our main focus is moving in net new core deposits into a bank versus a broker deposit. And that is one avenue that we could do that while still maintaining that product is insured.
So is the main differentiator versus like Stone Castle then is that the banks treat these as core deposits versus broker deposits?
Yes. So we have a long, stable, sticky deposits like 401k capital can stay and 10, 20, 30, 40 years. Class action lawsuit is a little bit different. It's like 90, 120 days. And we provide it in a hybrid mixture and versus just one customer, right? So when we provide a deposit, when a bank says we want 20 million, there is, you know, it comes across 1031 exchange, 401k, EB-5. We really want to make sure that's a diversified, stable, long-term deposit for them. And we are focused on asset managers, suppliers of deposits versus a bank to bank, whereas Stone Castle Entrify is moving excess deposits from one bank and moving it to another bank who is in need.
So they do have like their FICA account as well. And I think there's sort of retail versions like Max My Interest. So like from the RIA perspective, from the retail perspective or the asset manager, like what is the selling point there over those other options?
At the end of the day, well, there's two. One, and it depends on what asset manager you're talking to. So the first one is the spread and the potential earning of increase. For our first client, they were earning a 10 to 15 bip yield, and they are an over $700 billion assets under management firm. So if you're looking at $30 billion, 1 to 2 bips matter, much less 10 to 15 bips. And when you have a core deposit, you don't pay the higher insurance rate as a broker deposit, and you can lend against it 100%. So you're, as an institution, you're earning a lot higher yield. So these core deposits are much more valuable to you. So you can go to an asset manager and say, we'll give you 1 to 3% when they're currently earning 10 to 15 bips. And that's a very meaningful product. The second one is, as these large institutions move to ESG initiatives, they're really looking for opportunities, how to support communities, low to moderate income communities and communities of color. And they could do that through having a shared network through CDFIs and MDIs. A perfect example that was in the news recently was Netflix committing $100 million of deposits to an MDI. It's impossible to move $100 million to most MDIs because they're not large enough, but if you spread it across the network, you have that effect, right? And so we have the ability to do that at scale.
Thanks, Sinead. Great presentation. Liquidity is a universal problem, but of course, financial institution of different size will have different challenges. Can you talk a little bit more about your go-to-market strategy and where do you see immediate value across different segments of the market?
Yeah, of course. So our go-to-market is we have a wait list on both the demand and the supply right now. So we've actually closed off our wait list. We won't think about go-to-market until we move through that. We are focused on the first $2 billion of deposits moving onto the system and then into our financial institutions. And then second was, how do we think about that? To moving the products is we look at each financial institution to make sure they are in a good place to receive these deposits and at what rate and what term. And we work with them to make sure they have this stable, regulated balance sheet growth throughout the term of the relationship. And if they need loans to balance out those deposits, then we supply that for them.
Thank you.
Danae, can I just ask a question? So the platform that you're building here, if I've understood correctly, is basically a marketplace, right? Those with excess deposits looking for matching those with deposits, right? Is that a fair summary?
Correct. We are a two-sided marketplace. On one end, we have the asset managers or deposit suppliers, and then on the other end, we have financial institutions.
Okay. Who is the, so on each side of those, who is the person at this institution that basically you want to talk to? Like, who is the call that you want, the first call that you want to make? Whose problem is this?
Yeah, so it depends on the bank size, but primarily it's CFO, chief risk officer. If it's a larger bank, it is head of commercial, head of retail, or head of CRA. On the asset manager side, it is, it can range. And again, because like RIAs, they're like, the scale of size is varies greatly. So you could talk to a managing director of deposit solutions all the way down to a mom and pop shop that you're talking to the CEO of the RIA or the 1031 exchange.
Okay. How do you plan on scaling customer acquisition given the myriad buyer profiles or user profiles that you're targeting?
I can answer that question offline in greater detail, but what I'll say right now is we have access to probably around $30 billion. And right now that $30 billion represents a really great revenue opportunity for us. So we're really thinking through those first steps of getting that onto the platform and moving it through. And yeah, and I can get into detail of how we plan to go through that because it's not public information yet.
Understood. I was going to ask a question on unit economics, which I also suspect is not going to be public.
I could tell you at scale in terms of our margin and our treasury will be around 72%.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Danae. Thank you, judges. All right. As we move along here, we got a couple of companies left. So if we can have Chris Bracken of Moment. Chris, if you can, there you are. How are you? If you could show your screen. You? Good. All right. We can see your screen. You are set and your 7 minutes starts now.
Hey, good afternoon, everybody. My name is Chris Bracken. I'm the Chief Revenue Officer at Moment. Just to start, the data displayed in this presentation is for informational purposes only. Moment is not currently seeking any outside investment. So Moment is a platform solution that enables point-of-need lending, or we call point-of-need lending, connecting merchants and consumers with lenders at that critical moment in time. We're a lending platform that is really capturing the value of the transition to embedded lending. So if you think about that evolution of lending over time, it was a branch-based approach, obviously, in the pre-2000s years. If you needed a loan to do a home improvement project or a loan to do a really whatever, you were driving down to your branch-based lender to handle that transaction. Started to see the shift to digital lending with platforms like Lending Club and others, where a consumer could go and apply online for a loan. And where we are today is truly embedded lending. And so what that means is where that financial service is offered within the existing flows, within that existing time, so that the consumer can access the financial service or the financial product in that exact moment of need. We see that as a long-term structural shift and see that playing out over periods of decades. And we're really truly at the beginning stages of that shift. For us, we see embedded applications from a lending perspective in multiple verticals, whether that's home improvement or clean tech, whether that's things like power sports, elective medical, veterinary care, or certain retail segments. Our platform really enables the offering of embedded financial solutions for high intent, high value purchases in that consumer's specific moment. Today, Moment is offering is operating within the home improvement vertical and elective medical vertical, planning on launching in the clean tech and power sports vertical later this year. Our platform is really helping merchants and consumers access those financial services today, that loan product in that moment for these in these verticals today. So how do we serve these customers? So we have really three constituents we serve today. So consumers, merchants, and lenders. For our consumers, we're enabling them to have access to high quality loan offers to pay for the product or service they need in the moment that they're making the decision. really seeking out those consumers making high intent, high dollar purchases around their home or their healthcare. For merchants, we enable them to offer financial services, financial solutions to the consumer in that moment where they're selling the product or service. And we see merchants greatly benefiting from that ability to offer financing again in that moment. And finally, for lenders, our lending partners, we're delivering high quality consumer loans. And it's a really, truly a new digital channel for relationships as well. So why Moment? So Moment offers significant competitive barriers once Moment embeds into merchant software, payments, or processes. So really for our merchant customers, it creates a really sticky relationship where they're giving a simple, easy to use moment of need solution. Oftentimes this is coupled with either a private label or embedded API solution, where the merchant does not have to leave their existing platform. So whether that's a CRM platform or a job quoting platform and the like. It's really seamless from end to end. We've built everything from merchant underwriting to consumer loan servicing, all within one platform, meaning that consumers don't need to leave and merchants don't need to leave that platform in order to gain access to these loan products. You know, we really offer a competitive advantage in certain targeted sectors because of the way that we offer loan products and the way that we capture consumers within those products. We see our merchants greatly benefiting from the platform to that in a minute. And then ultimately, there's a high switching cost to leaving the platform, especially where they've built on top of or partnered with our API platform. We go to market in a pretty differentiated way for some of the players in the 1.0 space. So rather than being necessarily a forward-facing brand operating to acquire merchants directly, we have built an API interface that allows our partners to build on top of our platform. And Moment truly acts as infrastructure. We've created a fully automated process. Everything from merchant underwriting to consumer underwriting to transactions can occur in an automated basis. Our embedded lending APIs enable our partners to build Moment into their existing platform. So if they're a CRM platform or a job quoting platform or whatever it might be, they can now enable the offer of payments and lending in that existing platform without having to rebuild their or send the consumer, send the merchant elsewhere. This B2B2C distribution strategy for us creates great scale and great economy for our sales teams. We see very attractive merchant acquisition costs. We're operating in very high intent verticals around home improvement and healthcare, where consumers are making an educated decision around a high ticket purchase, which leads to better outcomes from a credit perspective. Our network relationships are extremely sticky, especially where they build on top of our platform. And then our data analytics and insights enables our partners to better run their business. And because of that, we've seen significant marquee partnerships sign up on the platform to date, including a variety of CRM platforms, manufacturers, distributors, and other specialty finance businesses. Ultimately, it comes down to that value proposition for those three constituents. The primary use case for our merchants is that it helps them sell more and increase their average ticket. One of my favorite stories is about a merchant we have in our platform in Florida. It saw a 69% increase in average ticket size when they switched to Moment. And if you think about it for this merchant, it's not necessarily about selling more jobs because they only have so many install crews, they only have so many hours in the day, but where they can offer a financial services product that enables them to increase the average ticket in that way, because the consumer can now truly afford the product or service that they're looking for with attractive loan offers. It really meaningfully impacts businesses. For our consumers, they see compelling offers at attractive rates offered in the right time to instantly enable them to make the purchase for their product or service. And our lending partners have seen high quality consumer loans, new customer acquisition, and a new channel for them to acquire customers for their platform. So from a performance standpoint, Moment today has over 2,400 merchants on the platform. These merchants are, range in size from mom and pop businesses to large sophisticated organizations. The merchants are primarily in the home improvement space. One of the things that we pride ourselves on is the activity rate of our merchants. Our merchants are utilizing the platform at a rate about double that of our competitors or more. We think that really speaks to the ease of the use of the platform, the value of embedding our lending APIs within their existing checkout flows, and the outcomes they see for their business and for their consumers. So that merchant growth coupled with the activity rate of our merchants on the platform, the utilization rate of our merchants on our platform, has led to pretty significant growth for the platform from an origination standpoint. In 2022, we went from $1 million a month in lending to $1 million a day. And so far in 2023, we've more than doubled that again. Our expectation is to do well over $1 billion in loan originations this year, all in high quality, high credit performance loan flow that benefit our lending partners across the platform. Loan has been very efficient in the way that we've built the business and grown the business. If you look at our cash conversion score, we're kind of running well outside the norm there. Our ARR today is exceeding $60 million. We'll do well over $100 million in revenue this year. And the business is scaling, kind of beyond, that initial phase where we were testing in market just a few years ago. So that's Moment. Moment's really, truly powering a shift in the long-term change to embedded finance. We're seeing that happening today in two verticals. Our long-term plans are to continue to expand into multiple verticals, allowing our partners, both on the merchant and lending side, to access these customers and offer financial services to these customers in that critical moment of need.
All right. Thank you, Chris. Judges, any questions?
Yeah, thanks, Chris. Quick one from me. So what's the average kind of loan size that you give to customers, and what's the cost it is to them? And when you say like moment of need, obviously it's in the name. So like, what's the time to application to decision process?
Yeah. So I answer the second question first. It's minutes, right? So the consumer is being invited to apply for a loan by the merchant. They receive a loan invitation via text message or email almost all the time via text message on their own device. They go through an application process. It's a short couple of screens on their phone. They receive pre-qualified loan offers, typically somewhere between 3 to 5 loan offers based on our underwriting and our loan product selection. And then they're able to select that loan product and transact with the merchant. In the field, we see that happen in 3 to 5 minutes. It's very seamless, very easy for that consumer and that merchant to transact. So in terms of the dollar side.
Just to understand that a little bit better. So there are loan partners that you work with, and then you charge basically a little bit on top of that. Is that the way that it works?
No, and I'm not going to kind of get into our economic model today, but the way we work with our merchants and lending partners is we act as an infrastructure layer, connecting merchants, consumers with lenders, but it's all based on our credit policies, our credit decisioning, our merchant underwriting. Our lending partners sign up for our platform, sign up for a portfolio based on a credit box that they're comfortable originating into. And we allocate loans based on the smart allocation engine that allows us to partner with multiple lending institutions and allocate loans in a smart way toward their portfolio based on the criteria they select.
Okay. And sorry, on the cost that it is to the customer and the average loan size?
Yeah, so our average loan size in home improvement is around $20,000.
Okay. And on average, how much like interest is the customer paying on that?
Yeah, it's a super prime portfolio. They're very, very attractive credit loan sizes or loan terms. But we have 35 different credit products on the platform, ranging from 0% APR all the way up, discounting depending upon what the merchant and the consumer are looking for in that transaction.
Okay. Thanks.
Sure.
Who are the lenders on the platform? Are these mostly like community banks and credit unions or alternative lenders?
Yeah, so to date, we've partnered exclusively with community banks and launching our first credit union partners very shortly, and also have institutional capital partners accessing both the securitization markets and others. So the value of the platform is truly to be multi-lender diversified funding on the back end, so that our consumers can receive, you know, a variety of offers based on their individual, you know, financial circumstance.
You mentioned that today you have lending product and two industry, and you do plan to expand into more. Can you talk a little bit more on how much a lift it will be from an R&D perspective if you were to expand that into more industry?
Yeah, sure. So our team as a team has underwritten more than $20 billion in consumer loan assets. We have great experience on our team, both, you know, running large scale lending programs as well as, you know, cold start lending programs, depending upon the verticals. So, you know, our team of data analytics, our credit policy folks, actually, I think you're from Citi yourself, aren't you? Our new head of credit is a former Citi person, you know, would stand up a vertical. For us, it's about credit product configuration, back testing the data through our models, and understanding what the loss curves and credit performance would look like within that vertical. Ultimately, to a certain degree, our product is a consumer unsecured installment loan. And so to some degree, a loan is a loan is a loan. We're looking at that consumer, underwriting that consumer, understanding what the use case is for the loan product, and then understanding what that loan performance profile looks like over time. The place we're playing in, high intent consumer purchases, we aren't financing sneakers, we're doing home improvement projects and the like, are typically higher performing credit and, homeowners, those kinds of things. And so we want to be around those spaces. So when we talk about clean tech, it's still a homeowner. When we talk about retail, for instance, it's still retail around home ownership, products around home ownership. So we're looking for that high intent, high value consumer who is doing projects or services around their home because of the value of that from a credit performance perspective.
Who's servicing the loans? Is it you guys or whoever ends up purchasing it through the platform?
Yeah. So we do is the answer. When our founders launched the business, they really kind of looked at what was out there across the industry and said, as practitioners, if we wanted to build this from scratch, what would be important to us? And because of that, they started with a 10,000 line data model that was the basis for building from Moment. And so what that data model allowed us to do is to do everything from the front end, merchant underwrite, consumer underwrite, loan service and the like, and feed that data all the way through the pipelines in both directions. That data is really valuable for us as we, you know, kind of use it to make better decisions over time. At this point, we've made something like 50,000 consumer loans across, you know, multiple verticals, multiple credit profiles, and really building that kind of database of consumer credit in these high intent moment of need purchases. It's really critical for us. And so we service the loans all the way through. And it's largely for us to understand the data and how that credit performs for our partners all the way through as well.
And assuming there's some sort of, you know, leverage distribution model as you kind of continue to dive into some of these other, embedded verticals, what have you found to be, obviously you've, you know, seen a lot of growth in home improvement. How do you, you know, tend to look at scaling into some of these other verticals?
Yeah. So when we look at a vertical, we want to understand, you know, who are the incumbent players within that vertical? Where is the value? How are merchants using financing if they're currently using it? And then where can we plug in and who can we partner with to make it as efficient as possible? And so oftentimes we're looking at things like who are the leading vertical SaaS players? Who are the platforms that those merchants in that vertical utilize to help run their business? And can we partner with or embed within those platforms to help that business, you know, access financing for their customers within the existing platform? So for instance, in the healthcare business, are there software platforms that help, you know, dentists run their practice, and how can we embed in that platform so that office manager can help their consumer pay for their service or the procedure, from that same screen. And so that's really how we think about that distribution. Ultimately, because we're selling through those distribution partners or those effectively channel partners, we've seen tremendously efficient acquisition costs. you know, our cost to acquire a merchant is well within, you know, kind of, you know, a 1 month payback or so in terms of that merchant transacting on the platform. So, you know, that model where we're partnering with folks, where that model where we're leveraging those existing relationships really has helped drive, you know, rapid merchant acquisition on the platform.
Are there any economics, any split there between the, you know, channel partners?
Absolutely. So in many cases, you know, this could be a new revenue channel for those partners, right? So just like you're seeing vertical SaaS, you know, businesses start to embed things like payments, think about embedding financing in the same way and can turn into a new revenue channel for those partners for sure. Also with things like manufacturers or distribution businesses, it could turn into a revenue channel or it could turn into a way that they can help incentivize that merchant over time to either buy more of their product or service. And so, yeah, I mean, part of the value here is turning that financing channel into a new economic vehicle that can have multiple use cases for our partners.
All right. We're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much to the judges. And of course, thank you very much, Chris. On to our final pitch for today's semifinal session. Vadim Lidic. Vadim, there you are coming up on screen. How are you? All right. So if you can share your screen and we'll get started with our final company. And your 7 minutes will start once your screen is up. All right, I see it. So you are good to go.
Thank you. And thank you so much for having me here today. My name is Vadim Lidic, and I'm a co-founder at PaperStack. And we're building a financial operating system specifically for the e-commerce industry. And let me start by sharing a story from one of our customers. A premium skincare brand started by two women, Alicia and Maisha, with just a few dollars in their pockets. Now, they quickly grew their direct-to-consumer brand to six figures. They were featured on Shark Tank. They got support from Sephora. A lot of opportunity. But despite all that, Alicia and her co-founder just couldn't get enough financing to help them purchase enough inventory and keep enough inventory in stock. And here's why. Venture capital is much more geared towards financing technology companies rather than direct-to-consumer brands, while banks and credit unions can potentially offer, you know, basic credit cards, but at that stage, that's pretty much it. And that's, you know, dear judges, is a bigger problem that affects over 40 million e-commerce sellers globally that have challenges accessing affordable working capital and resources that they need to grow. The fintech lenders out there, such as ClearBank and Wayflyer, they're our direct competitors, have historically only focused on basic platforms such as Shopify and Amazon. And they're unable to underwrite different types of channels such as wholesale and retail, while banks and credit unions just quite frankly make it very difficult for brands like Range Beauty to access financing. Not only that, there are over 40 million e-commerce brands that lack access to financing to manage and grow their businesses. That number, that $40 million e-commerce brands, was 20 million just 2 years ago at the beginning of the pandemic. And that number is expected to grow by 75% over the next 5 years. And that's exactly why we're so excited to support fast-growing consumer brands through PaperStack. We do that by providing access to working capital within 24 hours that e-commerce merchants need to grow their businesses. This capital helps them purchase inventory, invest in advertising, and hire more talent to reach both their revenue and profitability goals. Here's how it works. At the core of our technology product sits proprietary underwriting technology that allows us to access our customers' real-time financial data, evaluate risks, assign interest rates based on their ability to repay working capital. We analyze hundreds of important metrics that come directly from our customers' bank accounts, points of sale systems, and accounting reports. And because the entire process has been completely automated with the help of technology, we're able to make a funding decision within minutes rather than weeks. We are a team of repeat founders, seasoned finance and technology experts, as well as e-commerce operators. My co-founder and CEO, Asel Beglinova, spent 5 years in finance and banking, where she had thousands of uncomfortable conversations with small business owners explaining why the bank couldn't lend them money. Myself, I spent 5 years building technology companies in prop tech, fintech, legal tech, and esports industries. In 2019, I co-founded and exited an alternative mortgage lending platform that we grew to over $500 million in GMV while I was there. As of today, we've raised $7 million in equity and debt financing from top funds such as Gay Angels, Techstars Ventures, executives at companies like TD Bank, ClearBank, Wealthsimple, Sezzle, Coho, as well as leaders at companies like Shopify, Apple, and Google. All of them bring decades of operational, financial, and technological experience to the table. And so far, it's been working. Since launching PaperStack just 16 months ago, think about that, we've secured $20 million in lending facility, processed 500 loan applications from e-commerce brands across the United States and Canada, which translated into $1 million in ARR for our business. We've been growing our revenue by 100% month over month over the past 6 months on average, and attains an above industry average LTV to CAC ratio of 18 to 1. And because of our trajectory and the strong pipeline for our offering, we're projecting to reach $5 million in ARR over the next 12 months. But it won't happen by luck. We're solving a massive problem in a huge market that's been growing rapidly since the beginning of the pandemic. In the US and Canada alone, there are over 8 million e-commerce brands, translating into $240 billion a year opportunity for our business. And globally, that opportunity is measured in trillions. Here's how we make money. We charge a fee on the working capital that we provide, generating on average $39,000 in revenue for each loan that we originate. And because of how sticky and recurring e-commerce finance is, in our case, it's 80% customer retention and repeatability, we are able to earn 18 times more than we spend to acquire a customer today. We differentiate from our competitors by our ability to underwrite across multiple sales channels, allowing our customers to access more money faster. We're not just looking at Shopify or Amazon, but we're looking at wholesale and retail and a variety of custom platforms and payment solutions, allowing us to offer more financing. And because of our investments in proprietary underwriting technology, we're able to achieve 7 times lower default rates than our fintech competitors, while also prioritizing processing speed and convenience of our offering. But we're not stopping here. Our mission is to support e-commerce merchants around the world with financial tools and resources that they need to grow beyond just the working capital that we're offering today. And here's the best part. By funding more business owners like Alicia and Maisha, we can bridge the funding gap, allowing them to create more inclusive, high-quality products, hire diverse teams, pay them fairly, which in turn will create a positive economic impact and inspire, hopefully, the next generation of entrepreneurs. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Vadim. Any questions from our judges?
Yeah, quick question. Thanks, Vadim. Full disclosure, I sit on Wayflyer's board, so if you have anything that you don't want to disclose, just feel free. What's your cost of capital?
So right now we have an off-balance sheet lending facility. Since you've mentioned you sit on the Wayflyer's board, I'll probably keep that information to to ourselves, but to kind of give you a perspective, it's, you know, mid-teens. And it's a very standard sort of pricing for, you know, first balance sheet type or first off balance sheet type facility for the company of our stage. Okay. Obviously, cool. Where the interest rates are today as well.
Understood. And then, so you mentioned on a previous slide that your average loan is $150,000 and you're charging, so your revenue is $39,000. Is that right?
Per loan. Yeah.
Okay. So that's basically, like a 25% fee?
It's about 30%. Yeah, it's about 30% APR equivalent, about 50% IRR. If you think about reinvesting principal into other opportunities.
Is it a cash advance product? Is it basically revenue based finance?
Correct. So if you annualize the cost, it's about 30%. But obviously, the average, at least in our case, we're offering or tend to offer shorter term products. Think about 4 to 8 months in duration. And so, you know, factor rate on those will be around, you know, 10 to 16, but the annualized cost would be around 24 to 36%.
Okay. I don't think that math quite works out for me, but if you're charging 30% upfront and they pay it down over 4 months, then on an annualized basis, that can't be.
No, 30% annualized basis, we charge them, you know, 10% upfront, for example, if it's a, you know, if it's a 4 month, for example.
Okay.
I'll probably 10% fee on the 4 month translates into 30% on 12 months. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And what's the average tenor of a loan, or is it
right now in the portfolio it's 6 months.
Okay. Got it. Thanks.
And what is your total origination volume to date, if you can share?
Yeah, so far we've originated $5 million in loans.
Okay.
In the last 16 months.
Maybe getting more into kind of your kind of average, what your average customer looks like, kind of the size that they are, the revenue, and curious, I mean, I guess it's earlier in your life cycle, but, you know, as they grow, how do you expect to kind of continue to grow with them and meet their needs, right? Obviously, they're a less risky customer now, et cetera. Any color there would be great.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we work with the, you know, private label brands, direct-to-consumer brands, you know, retail brands that sell in the United States and Canada. Their revenue is usually anywhere from $1 million to $30 million a year, at least today, obviously, as our lending facility expands and we have, you know, access to more capital, given our performance, we also want to take on larger customers and, you know, advance more financing and obviously charge slightly less because of less risk and because of, you know, how much, you know, more safe those companies are. And so today, you know, we're working with, you know, with merchants of that size, you know, offering them anywhere from, you know, $10,000 to $500,000 in the form of a merchant cash advance.
So I think a lot of the competitors you showed, I mean, some of them do focus on e-commerce, but a bunch of the ones there are sort of more broad, and some of the ones that weren't listed, Funbox, Glühwein also. And so, you know, I think the presentation is very good, but it sort of relies on, you know, it seems like you're relying on the fact in this omni-channel thing, and so I just wanted to sort of double click on that. I like, yes, are you saying that your customers can't get approved by some of these other alternative lenders, or that they're getting lower amounts, higher interest rates?
Yeah, if you can imagine, like, you know, what a traditional sort of you know, private label company looks like today, you know, they sell across multiple channels. Some of those sales come through retail or B2B relationships. Potential deposit as a check or a wire or some sort of a payout from an unknown platform that's really hard to, you know, integrate into through like an API or access those same metrics consistently across multiple platforms. What we've done internally is we built a proprietary technology that allows us to access multiple types of sales channels and sources of payout information, reconcile that against their bank statements, reconcile against their accounting statements, and then have a much more holistic view of what their revenues are, you know, across multiple sales channels, what their expenses are, you know, across, you know, their entire company rather than a specific sales channel, and then underwrite based on that. So we're able to offer more financing as a result. We're able to, you know, collect based on more revenue. And, you know, as a result, we're able to consolidate in a lot of cases advances from a lot of, you know, other companies that can only offer financing from, you know, based on one channel. So Shopify Capital, for example, can only see Shopify revenue, and they will only offer financing based on what, you know, Shopify Pay processes on the platform, whereas we see their entire sales history across all the channels.
Okay, any other questions? All right, thank you, Vadim. And that will conclude our semifinal number one. So, you know, thanks again to our judges, Liren, George, Catherine, and Sandeep. And also special thanks to our six companies that joined us today, you know, for their time and attention for presenting. We'll be back again tomorrow. We'll have a new or a different group of judges and a new set of companies as well. So if you tuned in today, great. You can tune in tomorrow again. If you didn't, then you're listening to this on replay. I hope you enjoy it. And the finals will take place at FinTech Nexus USA, which is coming up in 2 weeks from today, May 10th and 11th. The finals will be May 11th at 10:30 in the morning on our expo floor at the Innovation Zone. So if you don't have tickets, make sure you go to fintechnexus.com and buy tickets right now. If you're a startup, you can buy tickets at the lowest rate possible. You just apply through the website, and there's lots of other rates available for all sorts of companies. So we encourage you to apply or purchase your ticket today. Special thanks again to our judges and to our audience. Enjoy the rest of your day, everyone.